Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here. And I want to sort of, I can divide the talk into, because I know there's a lot of interest as well in things that are happening now. And I recently was able to visit Gaza in the summer and fall of 2010 after a three-year absence during which I wasn't able to go back because of the blockade and the closures. And I have a lot of photos and you know, updates on that that I can get to maybe later. But before I kind of dive into that, because that can kind of veer us off track, I want to begin by talking a little bit about my own experience and journey in Gaza. And I'll just start with a map to orient people, because I refer often to a lot of things. And then I'll also do some readings from the book. As you can see, it's right now, Gaza is blockaded three ways. There's an aerial blockade, rather, a maritime blockade, and a land blockade. The naval blockade, or the maritime blockade, is pretty simple. It basically bans fishermen or people from going more than 3 nautical miles into sea. Now, that was reduced down from, in the Oslo Accords of the 1990s, Palestinians were given the right to fish 20 nautical miles into sea, which practically translated into about 12 at any given point, 4 at the worst of times, and now that's been reduced to 3. And they, once they pass that boundary, they're subject to all kinds of harassment and detentions, they're shot at, and so forth. And then aerial blockade, there was once an airport, you can use this nifty thing and point to it, right there. And I actually had a chance to use it twice. That was completely destroyed over the course of many years by the Israeli army. And so there's no way out or in of Gaza by airport or by air. The closest airport would be the Ben Gurion Airport up here somewhere, it's like over here, but Palestinians aren't allowed to use that. And so the principal entry in and out of Gaza then becomes the Rafah crossing right there, which I also refer to a lot and which I talk about a lot in the book. And you can only reach the Rafah crossing by first traveling through Egypt. And the closest airport is the Cairo airport, so you would need to fly into Cairo airport and then travel about 5 hours by land to the Rafah crossing and then wait to see if it's open, because it's not always open. And if and when it is open, entry is not guaranteed because there's huge backlogs of people trying to get through, security checks, and it might be closed indefinitely, arbitrarily, and you're never told for how long. And so that happens a lot throughout my journey, and it's what I describe as a quintessential Palestinian experience, always having to wait on borders, and it was a turning point for how my blog started, which I'll get to. Now, the only people that can use that Rafah crossing are Palestinians, Gaza residents, Palestinians with Israeli approved ID cards known as the Hawiya. The Israelis began issuing these documents in 1967 when they occupied the Palestinian territories, and they're territory specific. So if you are from Gaza, you were born in Gaza, or you were born to parents from Gaza with this ID card, then you get this ID card, and you can only use it to travel in and out of Gaza, not to the West Bank, not to East Jerusalem. And the reverse is true if you're from the West Bank. You can't use it to travel to Gaza or to East Jerusalem, which is why people often compare this system of control and movement, the Hawiya system, to an apartheid system. And so even you can't even give it to your spouse. There was once a system, an Israeli system, known as family unification, through which spouses could obtain resident ID cards and then be able to travel with you or live in your hometown or your home territory. But the Israelis have frozen that process since the late 90s, so there's tens of thousands of Palestinians who either have situations where they're technically living illegally in their own land or their spouses don't have the ID. So in my case, and I'm just giving you the background for the way that my journey started, I was living in Gaza, but my husband couldn't come with me and my son because he's a Palestinian without a residence ID. He's actually a Palestinian with refugee status. He grew up in a refugee camp in Lebanon. But this applies equally to any Palestinian who, would not have the ID card. And so I would have to travel back and forth. He was in the United States studying to see him. And again, this kind of is the underpinning of my blog and the reason I was traveling so frequently back and forth from Gaza during the time that I was working there. And then finally, over the past 3 years, after the Israeli disengagement from Gaza in 2005, when Israel withdrew its troops and dismantled the settlements but retained control, effective control over Gaza's markers of sovereignty, like the borders, the airspace, the land crossing the population registry that governs this whole system of ID issuance and who can go in and out of Gaza. They retain control significantly over this, this border right here, this red and pink line. They control, this is called the buffer zone, or the no-go zone, and it juts into two kilometers. What is that in miles? I keep forgetting. About 1.5 miles at any given point into Palestinian land. And the way it works is they have troops and watchtowers stationed all, you know, on the perimeter of the border, not inside. And anyone who's within range of that buffer zone, and of course you can't tell, it's not demarcated, so you have a lot of farmers, shepherds, children running around who live in that area that often get shot and killed. I think there's been Defense for Children International reported 22 children have been killed in that buffer zone since Operation Cast Lead in 2009. And in January, there was a shepherd killed. When I was there in September, there was a farmer and his two grandchildren who were killed over here. So it's pretty, it happens pretty frequently. The problem is 35% of Gaza's arable land, its agricultural land, is located in that buffer zone. So it creates a serious problem for Gaza's agricultural economy as well. Anyway, that's just an overview of kind of the border situations and different kinds of borders that I refer to a lot. This border is one that leads directly into Israel, ultimately to the West Bank and East Jerusalem, the other parts of the Palestinian territories. But it's reserved now principally for foreign aid workers, international journalists, and so on. So really, this is the only crossing that Palestinians can use. It has been jointly enforced and closed by Egypt and Israel over the past few years. And during the Mubarak regime, was closed completely for 3 years. It's recently been reopened with a change in the regime, but again, only for Palestinians with the Israeli approved ID card, no one else. So that's the situation with the border. And again, I can talk more about that. Maybe I'll show a little clip before I go on that gives people, this is a picture of the buffer zone in the north that I was talking about. The entire, you know, area of farmland was cleared off. That's the Israeli side over there, and here's the Palestinian side. There's this short clip that I usually like to show before I kind of get into the rest of my talk, called Closed Zone, and it was created jointly by this Israeli director, Yoni Goodman, who also directed Waltz with Bashir, if any of you have seen that. And Gisha, another NGO that I refer to quite frequently, it's an Israeli NGO that works for the freedom of movement of Palestinians. It's called the Legal Center for Freedom of Movement, based in Tel Aviv. And their work focuses almost exclusively on highlighting issues of closure, blockade, things like that, around the Gaza Strip that are enforced by Israel. And so this was created, I think, last year. It's a 60-second clip that really helps people kind of visualize what we mean when we say Gaza is a closed zone, because it feels like there's always got to be some other way. And I live near Washington, and I tell people it's like when it's during the Cherry Blossom Festival. People find it, you know, closures seem convenient, like so-and-so road is closed off, you have to, you know, but it's, and I say it's more than that. It's not like the red line is closed and you have to go to a different subway stop. It's like you can't use Dulles Airport. It's like you can't go to the Children's Hospital in Washington if you lived in a Maryland suburb. You can't even go to Washington. You can't. So that's what it means like to be in Gaza, and when we say it's a closed zone, let's see if the audio works on this. Oops.
Oh, okay.
So I'm just going to backtrack now and talk a little bit about, you know, my own story and the book. Now, if you ask anyone that's recently been to Gaza or that's from Gaza how the situation is, the response will invariably be, it's abnormal and normal. What I mean by that is, you know, if I ever ask my aunt, I call up and I say, you know, how are things going? And she says in Arabic, Alhamdulillah, zay zift. So, you know, thank God things are crap. So that's, you know, that's the reality. This is Gaza's reality, where Palestinians have had to continuously adapt to ever-changing and perverse forms of Israeli occupation and control. They, you know, Gaza has always been subject to some form of closure. There's this kind of narrative that it's recent, you know, since the elections, but it's actually not true. For more than a decade, Gaza has been closed off in varying degrees, leading up to sort of the most absolute of closures in the past few years. And where I usually say that surviving in and of itself is an act of resistance. There was one woman after the Palestinian elections in 2006, and it had just been announced that sanctions were going to be slapped on the Palestinian Authority because of the results during which the Hamas party won. And the parliament was convening nonetheless in March, and there was one woman watching, and I asked her what she thought about all this, and she said, "Our lives are incomprehensible." And I always remember that statement, because how can an average person then assess such an incomprehensible situation like Gaza? How can you assess a place that's so surveilled and so mediated and so prescribed that it becomes nearly impossible to distinguish truth from fiction, conspiracy from reality, normality from abnormality? Even as a Palestinian from Gaza myself, and as a reporter when I was there, having, you know, have trouble doing this. And people themselves can tell you, how can you really assess these kinds of things? We have the bleak statistical indicators and the aid reports that we're always getting, and the eyewitness testimonies. And usually they're all saying the same things. Gaza's on the brink of humanitarian crisis. You know, the unemployment rates are sky high, the poverty. And that's generally all we hear. That's what Gaza becomes in our minds. You know, people throwing rockets or masked gunmen or poverty rates or, you know, overcrowding. That's what we think of when we think of Gaza. And the coverage from local and regional media tell us kind of the same thing. We hear about the latest assassinations and internal feuds between Hamas and Fatah. And occasionally, in the case of the West Bank, Guinness records that have been broken where walls and sieges have not. It's kind of the latest trend now. Even in Gaza, every year they do something really funny to break some kind of new Guinness. Like, how many kids can bounce a ball at the same time? Or how many kids can fly a kite? Or what? Making the world's largest knafa. So these are the kinds of the claims to fame that the West Bank and Gaza have now had. And we hear the rehearsed rebuttals and denials from government spokespersons and so forth. And we might even read contradictory reports about how the economies are thriving and, you know, in the West Bank, and people are getting on just fine in Gaza, and how there's food coming in. You know, we might hear the Israeli government and council saying, oh, we're letting in food, you know, we're easing the blockade. So things are okay. You know, what is the big fuss about? And we might even hear people themselves saying, no, we're doing fine, mainly because more than anything, they resent being depicted as victims. And this is really a message that was driven home when I went back this summer. People kept saying, it's not a siege of food, it's a siege of freedoms. And they kept emphasizing, it's on our freedom to farm, our freedom to fish, our freedom to move and to get educated and to breathe. That's really what it's about. And in fact, if you really study, this is a separate issue, but if you really look at what the tenets of the blockade are meant to achieve, it's just that. It's actually saying there's no humanitarian crisis. That's not what they want. But no development and no prosperity. They're trying to ban certain items that would allow factories to rebuild, people to prosper. And there's even cable exchanges between the American and Israeli embassies in 2008, released through WikiLeaks, that in fact the Israelis say, you know, we want to keep Gaza on the brink of collapse, and the Americans, you know, going along with saying, okay, so it's recognized, official stated policy, that that's what the siege is about. So then how do you understand, how does the average person understand Gaza in the face of all of this? And more importantly, how do you explain Gaza? How do you tell the story of Gaza? This has been a question I myself have struggled with for many years, particularly at times when I've had to grapple with situations that seem so routine and so ordinary, so quiet, and yet are so much of what Palestinian scholar Rashid Al-Khalidi calls the quintessential Palestinian experience. Now, what does he and what do I mean by that? It's an experience that takes place on airports and borders and checkpoints, any one of the many modern barriers where identities are checked and verified. and they're in no way extraordinary, but rather constitute the backdrop of daily Palestinian existence. So it's not, you know, the images, the quintessential Palestinian experience is not being bombed or not, you know, having your house destroyed or you know, getting detained. It's this. This is the Palestinian experience, always having to wait on borders, waiting for permits, waiting in airports. In my case, being stranded by the border for days and sometimes week at a time with my young son, when he was a few months old, attempting to obtain travel permits to the West Bank to attend, at that time, you know, an academic conference, or waiting for Israeli family unification approval for my husband. I talked about this process of family unification through which spouses can unite and be able to live or visit their homes together, to enable him to come visit Gaza and come visit his Palestine, where he's from, with us. These are the kinds of things that I grappled to explain to people, because they seem so bureaucratic and so boring, and all these details. Why would people really want to know about this when they want to understand the situation in Gaza or Palestine? How can I help people understand that it's these most ordinary moments that truly define what it meant to be Palestinian? How could I tell the story of my Gaza, of Palestine, of dispossession, the common and quintessential Palestinian experience? My own story goes something like this in brief. I was raised between Gaza and the Arabian Gulf, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Kuwait, where I was born, and where my parents worked for most of my childhood. Now, the reason we were there is because they had jobs there, like many Palestinians during the 70s and 80s, but we commuted back to Gaza on a yearly basis to renew our Israeli-approved identity documents, without which we would have been banned from entering Palestine. So there was a system where you had to renew this, and it was really made as difficult as possible, all these bureaucracies. And if you didn't renew your ID card, you couldn't go back, even though that's where you were from and, you know, your whole family was from, you wouldn't be able to go back to Gaza. And it was this effort of indirect transfer of the population. And though you don't need to renew your ID card if you're from Gaza anymore, you can't get an ID card, as I was explaining. And it still applies to East Jerusalemite residents, Palestinians from East Jerusalem, where you need to go through all these hoops to renew your ID card. If you're studying in college in the US and you don't go back to East Jerusalem, whatever, I think every 3 years, you lose your ID card, your residency is revoked, and you can no longer go back to visit your family, to live there, whatever. So that's what we were going through during that time. We would commute back and forth. Now, eventually they retired and returned to Gaza. I came to the United States to study. And in 2003, a year out of graduate school, I returned to Gaza, this time to work for the then nascent Al Jazeera English website, which is the predecessor to the channel. Now, I began to commute again from Gaza, but this time to the United States, where my husband was studying. And as I was explaining, as a Palestinian with refugee status who grew up in a camp in Lebanon without Israeli-approved ID cards, he couldn't come to Gaza with me. So I started blogging, mainly to bridge this gap and to help keep him abreast of what was going on in Gaza, but also what was happening, the developments of our first child, Yusuf, who was always with me at the time, who was very young. He was 2 months when I took him back to Gaza. And so my blog was originally named Raising Yusuf and eventually turned into Gaza Mom. And it was initially a family diary of sorts. And I started it just to kind of put you in perspective in 2004. It wasn't a time when a lot of people were blogging. There was a handful of blogs in the Middle East as a whole, maybe like 20 or so, none in Palestine. So it was kind of a novelty at the time. And you know, only this summer, blogging has really kind of bloomed in Gaza, where there's been a bunch of you know, young girls that have started blogs, which is fantastic. Now, at the time, it was something fairly new, and it morphed into something more than a family diary. It changed into the story of how the personal is violated and immersed with and often overtaken by the political for Palestinians. And one fall in 2004, my son was 9 months old, and we were on our way back to Gaza through Egypt. I was showing you how we have to fly into Cairo. And we were coming from the United States, and then we learned that that crossing was closed. We were about to head to the crossing. And well, we wondered for how long. And I mean, as a Palestinian growing up, having to commute all my life, that was always a problem, but it for some reason never hit me. You know, here I was with a young child, and I was told the border was closed, and it ended up being a month and a half closure. And you know, we were completely not prepared for this. We were stuck. I mean, I'm not from Cairo. You know, I had a friend that I stayed with her, but she was studying, and we were kind of, you know, going from day to day wondering when would the border open, what was gonna happen, when would it ever open, you know, would our status change? And that's really when I began, you know, the blog changed, as I was explaining, to something about the political, the personal as political. And I began blogging sort of about our daily experiences and trials, about everything from what I say in my blog, border potty training to border crossings. So blogging when I was there was my coping mechanism, but it was also a kind of portal into Gaza, my own way of challenging the status quo and explaining Gaza, explaining not just Gaza but dispossession, and explaining the Palestinian experience in a, you know, sort of a non-confrontational way. Well, this is my life. I'm not trying to make something up or make it seem more dramatic than it is. You don't really have to do that. And in this context, I felt a duty to blog and inform the world about our lives and all their banalities and horrors under occupation. But in the early days, I really struggled. Well, what was I blogging about? You know, why was I blogging? Did I have a right to blog when I didn't have it as bad as the person in the village north of me, or you know, the person whose house was demolished or lost three children? You know, here I was in Gaza City, relatively comfortable. Yes, we, you know, were bombed and so on and so forth. But who was I to sit here and speak on behalf of everyone? And my feelings were confounded by the fact that at the time my blog was the only one in Gaza, and it was a very lonely time. And I felt a heightened responsibility to urgently report every detail that was unfolding around me, which I couldn't always do, of course. But I always wondered, well, how can I make people see what I was seeing? How can I make them experience this? How can I make them live Gaza, essentially, and to show them that it's not just the horrors and the blood and the gore on every corner, but it's that there is love and life and happiness in spite of all of this. And that was really the point of it all. How could I help show Palestinians as human beings rather than as abstractions and figures? And then, you know, why? What should I be blogging about? Was it making sense? Was it accurate? Did it have to be? And so eventually I continued to blog over the course of, you know, the time I was in Gaza and reporting. Through, you know, I'm still blogging, but the book basically is a compilation, a chronological compilation of my blogs, but then my reporting also as well, and covers a period when I was in Gaza reporting through the from the Israeli disengagement from Gaza, a very critical time, which is very often misunderstood, through the Palestinian elections when I was there, and then eventually during this period of 3 years when I was outside of Gaza from 2007 to 2010, when I couldn't, I tried to go back and I was detained by Egyptian authorities and then sent back here until the present. And it covers this period of 5 years. And for me, it's really helpful to kind of to understand the current day, what's unfolding right now, to kind of zoom out a little bit and see what happened over the past few years. And what emerges is a theme, a consistency and constancy with the way that Israeli policies play out on the Palestinian side, regardless of who's in power. whether it's Mahmoud Abbas or Yasser Arafat or Ismail Haniyeh, it doesn't matter. The policies are quite consistent. That's what you learn by looking into this window of time. And so it basically tries to give an personal understanding of what's happening. And it's a window into Gaza during some of its most turbulent years. But ultimately, it's a story about mothering, homeland, identity, war, and survival. And so that's my story and the book. And what I'd like to do is maybe do a few readings from the book, and then we can do some question and answer, and I can go back to the show you some more slides from the present. I'm wondering if I should do that now or later, because I often get questions about, well, how are people coping? And I have a lot of really nice slides to kind of illustrate. Maybe I'll do that first. The readings are very, a lot of them are really emotional, so. Gaza in the summer after 3 year absence, excuse me, was the proliferation of diesel-powered generators. Because what happened is in 2007, as a punitive measure for the capture of an Israeli soldier, Gilad Shalit, the Israeli army destroyed Gaza's power plant. And over the years, the EU and others have rebuilt it, but it's not fully operational, so only a few of the turbines are functioning. And the result is electricity has to be rationed out to people in 8-hour blocks, so you don't have electricity for 8 to 12 hours at a time, and then you have it for 8 hours, and then it goes out again, depending on where you live. And so there's a mass dependence. It's not like certain neighborhoods or certain areas that are more remote have to use these. This isn't Gaza City. Mass dependence on diesel power generators. And they're really noisy and very dangerous because of the fumes, the carbon monoxide fumes they emit. And they only power up things like lights or, you know, you can charge your laptop and things like that, but you can't do much more. People have them for 2 or 3 hours at a time. You can't use refrigerators. You can't use, you know, anything that required air conditioners. So it was a very hot summer. And unless you live in a high-rise building that has a really expensive big generator, you know, this is what you have to rely on. That was a huge change. And I have a video of what it sounds like. On a routine power outage, when the power goes out. Accurate. I mean, it's really loud, and you know, the whole street lights up and buzzes with the sound of the generators once the electricity goes out. For a while, people were using these clay composite ovens to bake bread in, which is a traditional method that, but you know, hasn't been used in a long time because fuel, cooking gas, was really in short supply as part of the blockade. That's one of the things that are banned, and especially during the war, during Kassad, I still found them being sold all over northern Gaza. But now fuel is a little cheaper because they've devised a method, Palestinians, to smuggle it through the tunnels. This is an example of a mosque that was built out of the same material because one of the things that's also not allowed in line with the whole no development, no prosperity, is cement. It's only allowed in limited quantities. So people, there's been about 20,000 houses built out of this material. But again, they found devised ways to smuggle in the, this is the border between Egypt and Gaza. And they devised ways to smuggle in the cooking gas through these tunnels. They have these pipes that go through and they bring in everything from livestock, as you can see, to gas, to cars, to everything you can imagine. You can put in requests if you need a computer or whatever. And there's this whole system and everyone is in on it. I mean, the Egyptians, the Palestinians, and it's not a, It went in 2007 when I made a film about the tunnels from being a, you know, underground black market to being a completely regulated part of the economy. It's taxed, it's, you know, everyone that, you know, deals with it. The shops all have tunnel goods and you can see, you know, whatever you want to get. There was a time when generators were really difficult to come by. They all come through the tunnels now. And again, it's not something Palestinians necessarily want. It's very dangerous. So many young people are killed digging these tunnels, and often they're gassed out, or they were during the refugee by the Egyptians, or they were bombed by the Israelis. And it's, you know, obviously a certain segment of society profits greatly from this, and that's not something that people like either. And so, but you know, their argument is that once, if the borders open, if Israel and Egypt open up the borders for commerce, you wouldn't need tunnels anymore. And it's true, once the tunnels, the borders do open, the tunnel trade ceases. There's a direct relationship. And the way it works is you have these tents, and then each tent is a tunnel operation in and of itself, basically. And you it begins by a very small hole, and it kind of expands once it goes down further. One thing that they have been doing is recycling destroyed homes and creating this kind of composite cement out of it. And here they sift, this is the final process, stage of the process. They sift it through these big machines all over northern Gaza. You see these operations going on. But the problem is, because this material was, it was, you know, bombed initially, there were houses that were bombed, this kind of cement has high amounts of residual depleted uranium and all kinds of other chemicals they've been testing, that they've been doing on them. So it's, you know, dangerous if children and others are exposed to it. This is mainly what they're using to rebuild from right now. And only 12% of Gaza had been rebuilt after the war in 2009. This man I saw planting olive trees in northern Gaza, and I asked what he was doing, and he said his farm had been razed to the ground for the third time, most recently during the war. But he said, he was very positive, and he said, I have no choice but to replant the land, and you know, I can't just abandon it or leave it, then, you know, then they've won. And so, people, there's a very resilient spirit in Gaza. There's also a very entrepreneurial spirit. This man and his brother started Gaza's first freshwater fish farm. And it's absurd to think that you would need to have freshwater fish farms in the coastal enclave like Gaza, but because of the maritime siege and ban on fishing beyond 3 nautical miles, it makes fishing in large quantities very difficult. So these two brothers 2 years ago started this farm, and it's spread like wildfire. They provide the little whatever it is, baby fish, to other farms. And in fact, international NGOs like CARE and others have adopted these this model and have now are funding fish farms all over Gaza. There's also been large dairy and chicken farms that have started up in the area where the former Israeli settlements used to be. And of course, they're not nearly enough. These are dairy cows, but they're not nearly enough to sustain all of Gaza's population. So it doesn't substitute for things that would need to come in through the borders. But it is something that they're doing to activate the land. And a lot of these were actually destroyed during the war as well. But something else that's been going on is a shift that I noticed over the course of 3 years to more traditional and sustainable methods of agriculture. This was an organic farm I visited in northern Gaza. And then I would learn later there was a small government organic composting facility in central Gaza that they provide the compost for free to encourage farmers to pledge to farm organically to reduce their dependence on imported and unregulated chemicals and fertilizers and so forth. Because whenever the problem is, you know, you can't plant or farm with consistency because the borders will suddenly close, the commercial crossings, and then you can't export things like strawberries, which for a long time the Israelis, when they were still inside Gaza, were subsidizing farmers to plant. But once they disengaged from Gaza and closed the borders, they couldn't export the strawberries anymore. And so they lost their livelihoods, and then now they're returning to what they used to plant, things like date palms and olive trees, and again, trying to reduce their dependence on imported materials and so forth. This is the composting farm, and then this is a mushroom farm that I saw in southern Gaza, which is also something new to Gaza. And this is an agricultural engineer who was telling me it provides a supplemental form of protein, and they're teaching women how to cultivate it as a form of income generation. So that's something else that they're doing as a coping mechanism. And this is just an example of a strawberry farmer that lost his livelihood when the crossing is closed and he couldn't export his strawberries. And increasingly, women are becoming the breadwinners of their families as well because of the high unemployment rates. So that's just a little bit about how people are coping and what's going on right now. Another big problem is with materials that are usually recycled that are collected by Palestinians for profit, such as copper wires and generally the metal framing of old buildings or whatever, things like that. They're usually collected, and then in the past they would be sold to Israeli companies for profit by Palestinians. Now that's one of the things that's banned under the blockade, so there's hundreds and thousands of tons of this stuff. I had a picture somewhere, but I can't seem to find it. You're all over northern Gaza, and that's something else that's, you see, it's like this big mass of metal, basically rusting metal, all over northern Gaza, in addition to the cement recycling operations that you see over there. So that's just kind of a little perspective on what's happening right now, and I can refer to other slides if questions come up. But let me just do maybe a few readings as well to give you a sense of the book, and then you can use your question and answer. this is called, this is called What Do I Tell a Two-Year-Old? And it was written in 2006, and or let me just make sure I'm getting the right date. At a time when the border to the Rafah crossing was closed, that crossing that I showed you earlier. And my son and I were stranded in an Egyptian border town called Arish, about half an hour from Gaza, waiting for the border to open. And by this point, yes, it was at the very end of 2006. By this point, my son, who had gone through all of these trials with me since he was an infant, was becoming a little more cognizant of what was going on and beginning to ask more questions where he wasn't necessarily before. So what do I tell a two-year-old? He keeps asking me about the border. Yusuf, I mean, that's my son. He overhears things, ma'bar this and ma'bar that, and ma'bar is the word that we use to refer to the Rafah crossing. And so naturally inquisitive, he asks what we are doing and why we are still here, and each question is followed by another and another. Yusuf, and the conversation is in Arabic, but it's translated. Mama, can I ask you something? Yes, anything, my love. Why are we still here in Arish? Because we're waiting to enter Gaza, dear. Then why don't we go to Gaza? Well, because the Ma'bad is closed, my love. Why is it still closed, Mommy? Silence. Mommy, why is it still closed? I don't know, I don't know. I know, my dear, but do you really want to know? Do you really need to know? Well, who's closing it, Mommy? What do I tell him? Some bad people, I say. You mean like in the stories, like Shere Khan in the Jungle Book? Yeah, sure, I guess, like Shere Khan. But who are they? Who are these bad people? Is it the Yehud, he says, mimicking what he's heard on the border? That's the Jews in Arabic, what Palestinians used to refer to Israelis. What do I say? I hesitate. Look, there's just some people. Some of them are good, some of them are bad, like people everywhere. And the bad ones are closing the border. But why? What did we do? I wish I knew, my dear. I wish I had all the answers so I could answer all your questions, and I wish I didn't have to answer such questions to start with. But now I do, and what can I say to you? Mommy, please tell them to open it. I tried, Habibi, wallah, I tried. Try harder, try again. And this time, say, Yusuf wants to enter Gaza. Maybe they'll listen. And so here it goes. Dear Mr. Peretz, this is Amir Peretz, the Israeli defense minister at the time. My son Yusuf, 2 years and 9 months, would like me to inform you that he wants to enter Gaza. He has asked me to tell whoever it is who is keeping it closed to open the border for him immediately. In fact, he asks me every day, and now asking is no longer sufficient. He wants answers, too. Why is the border still closed? And who is keeping it closed, and why? So in addition to asking you to open the border, I'm also writing to ask you what I can tell a two-year-old to satisfy his insatiable curiosity. What can I tell him of borders and occupation and oppression and collective punishment? What would you tell him? Lying doesn't work. Two-year-olds are like natural-born lie detectors. And so he figures it's the bad guys, like in the stories we all read growing up. And now he demands to know who the bad guy is. What do I tell a two-year-old, Mr. Peretz, about the bad guy who won't let him return home? A Palestinian mother. And actually, an Israeli journalist took this, one really renowned journalist, Gideon Levy, wrote about this incident in Haaretz. And then later, another Israeli journalist who was a friend of mine actually hand-delivered the letter to Amir Peretz. You know, not that it did much good, but the point is, it's a small, tightly knit society, both Palestinian and Israeli society, and the journalists that cover it. And often, you know, blogging, I did feel I would often have some influence, whether it was something being read or in an op-ed or, you know, influencing others in the blogosphere. All right, let's see. This is called The Politics of Uncertainty. It was written during the same period of waiting. It's our third day in Aish, and still no word about the border. Everyone is suddenly a credible source on when it will open, and anxious ears listen. One local jeweler insisted it would open at 4 p.m. yesterday, a suggestion that taxi drivers laughed off. They placed their bets on Thursday. But Thursday has come and gone, and still no sign of the border opening. The woman staying in the flat next to us, a Palestinian-Syrian businesswoman also waiting to enter Gaza, says she has credible information the border will open in a matter of days. Atiya, our taxi driver, says he heard it would open. It wouldn't open until the Muslim pilgrimage, a few weeks from now. A border official we call every morning at 5 a.m. says only the Israelis know for sure. How is it that when waiting for passage through borders, time is suspended, yet somehow the rest of the world goes on uninterrupted? How is it that all sense of time and belonging in life come to a standstill? An Israeli friend put it like this: uncertainty is used as part of the almost endless repertoire of occupation. In the end, security is all that matters and all that ever will. Our identity has come to be defined by restrictions and borders and permits and limits. That is the nature of occupation. If you are from Gaza, you cannot travel to the West Bank. You cannot travel to Jerusalem. You cannot use Allenby, Jisr, or Erez, or any of the airports. You cannot obtain travel permits for you or your spouse, nor family unification. You cannot obtain identity cards. You cannot fly. You cannot fish. You cannot move. You cannot breathe. You cannot live. If you meet all of these cannots, then you know you are from Gaza. Okay, this is called It's in the Details, and this is actually written from when I was in Durham, North Carolina, living there for a while. And my parents were in Gaza City, and they were there during the war on Gaza, during Casled, and I wasn't. And we were having daily communications on Skype and on phone when the electricity allowed. And I was, in essence, you know, sort of inadvertently amplifying their experience all throughout the period of the war. This was written 2 days before the beginning of the war. We didn't know it at the time, but things were getting really grim and very difficult for them. And so anyway, you just have to kind of bear with it. It's called It's in the Details. We celebrated Eid al-Adha last week with my brother. That's the Muslim festival of the sacrifice. We made a 7-layer chocolate cake and decorated it to look like the Kaaba, around which the kids circulated 7 times as though performing a gastronomical pilgrimage. As usual, I Skyped my father to wish him glad tidings and to hear of the death of his cousin, the one who always sat on the street in front of Khamis's store, sipping sparkling water in the green bottles from Egypt. The funeral coincided with Eid, so my father's scraggly, awkward stubble of a beard, which he was growing in anticipation of the holiday following the prophetic tradition, could have been easily mistaken as a sign of respect in the incidence of a close family member's death, 2 in 1. The news seemed to get darker by the day. At first, they were happy with losing power for only 4 hours a day, then 8, 12, and 15 hours, and now they are going for 18 to 20 hours of outages at a time. They have a generator, purchased from the Tunnel Grey Markets in Rafah, says my mother. It's giving them some problems, and so they've sent it to be fixed by a local mechanic. The local mechanics fix anything there, old microwaves, broken toasters, laptops, digital cameras, blenders. Most learned during their days as laborers in Israel in the 1980s. In addition to the generator, they also share a line with our neighbors, the ones who own a famous Gaza boutique, who are originally from Nablus, 5 brothers. They are on a different grid, and so outages are at different times. We're Skyping less and less these days, and when the electricity is on, my father takes the opportunity to log on immediately. How are things? I ask, non-facetiously. Well, we got a bird. What? A hassoun, a goldfish. You know, they're quite rare these days. Doesn't he get cold? You're just like your mom. She asked the same question. Birds don't get cold. How do you think he survives in the wild? But anyway, I cover him at night and put him out on the balcony during the day. But he's not in the wild. Anyway, where did you get him? The guy who takes care of your mom's land in Mawasi. He likes to catch quails and caught this hassoun, and so I bought it from him. He gave us cauliflower and cabbage from the land, chimed in my mother. She rambled on about the land and the man who is taking care of the land and the condition it's in and what's growing there and what the plans are for it, or lack thereof. Details which now escape me. The land used to be my grandfather's and it's quite sentimental to her. The details seem boring. But they're what keep them going, what keep us all going. You see, trying to find a way to keep up with the boring details, to manage them, also keeps alive the illusion of normalcy. It's some kind of anesthetic, I suppose. It keeps the hope afloat that the dawn is near, even if near is actually not so near at all. Okay, I guess I'll stop there. I can do some more if people are interested. I'll give you a question and answer.
Yeah, feel free to ask Layla anything. And I should mention that the bookstore is here. They graciously brought some copies of her book. If anybody's interested, they have it back for sale at the back table. But let's take some questions. I'll just let you moderate that.
Okay.
So go ahead.
Yeah. When the border is open, how long about is it open for?
It really varies on the time and the circumstance. I mean, there's, you know, throughout the book I chronicle this whole period of, you know, closures and basically, you know, there's periods where it's just closed completely. Like, for example, from 2007 to 2010, there was a hermetic closure of Gaza, and it was only maybe, it got to the point where finally, after a lot of pressure, because people kept felling the border every year, so there would be enough people would go to the border, and just a mass of people would, go and break it down, and then because it was closed for so long. So it got to the point where they began to open it once a month for 2 days or something, but only for specific people, you know, people that were pre-approved, run by the Egyptian government, the Israeli governments, and so forth. So it wasn't like anybody who just wanted to, who was even from Gaza, to go and use the border. And then after the incidents with the flotilla, with the attack on the convoy of ships that were headed to Gaza last year, the Egyptian government, in a bid to ease pressure on itself, actually reopened the border. And then it was open for that whole year until the uprising in Egypt. It closed for a month and then it reopened. And so during that whole year, it was just open. But again, there was categories that couldn't use, if you couldn't prove that you had residency abroad, you know, if you left Gaza, they wouldn't allow you back in, or something like that. It was all these weird conditions that were placed where you had to prove that you weren't a, you know, whatever, like a flight risk or something like that, that you weren't gonna go to Egypt and stay there. That was the excuse they used. But I mean, most Palestinians, you know, the 99% obviously just wanted to go in and out for whatever reason, like anybody wants to. During the years prior to the Hermetic closure, I would say it was, you know, there was always closures. It was maybe open a few times a week, maybe 2 days a week, and there would be periods where we closed for 2 weeks and then we open. And so because of, and then when it was open, even when it's open in the best of times, it's only open for maybe 4 or 5 hours. And so you can imagine you have 3,000 people on any given day that need to use that crossing, and when it's closed for several days or only open for 3 hours, you have this gigantic backlog. So it was really a nightmare trying to get out at any given time when we heard the border was open and I had a, you know, ticket booked out of Cairo. I've missed so many tickets. You just have to kind of wait amongst masses of people on the border. And for a while there were European monitors acting as proxies for the Israelis, and that didn't work, and they're no longer there. So it's always been a bit of a mess. It's never, you know, when you think of a border, you think of something that's open continuously and consistently, like an airport or even any land crossing. It's not that way. It's kind of always kind of arbitrary, you know, subject to certain restrictions. And again, only Palestinians with these ID cards can actually use it in the end of the day when it is open, you know, in the best of circumstances. So, a little longer than you wanted. Yeah.
What's the reception been like to your block in Gaza itself and the other blocks? Have the majority supported your efforts to get these personal stories out to the world, or do others like demand, you know, more tangible, more direct attack?
Yeah, I mean, for a while, you know, initially, like I said, when I was blogging, there was really no one else. There was a lot of what are known as bridge bloggers, people who are blogging about Palestine or issues in Palestine, but not, you know, who are not necessarily from there. And there was even a study written by the Brookman Institute in Harvard about, it's called Mapping the Arab Blogosphere, and they did find that, you know, the Palestinian blogosphere was very sparse compared to other Arab countries until recently, and the Palestinians preferred forums, like dialogue forums and things like that. And so it's true, people would, you know, the tendency is people feel like in order to really make a splash, the only way they could show people what was going on was to, you know, whatever, publish the most gory pictures or to really show, you know, and of course it's awful, but that doesn't always resonate with people in the same way that just a very, I mean, ordinary story does. And it wasn't until this summer when I went back to Gaza and I had one guy following me on Twitter, you know, from Gaza, and he, when I announced that I finally made it back, and he said, oh great, I want to arrange a meeting with all these other people who are interested in blogging or are blogging. And it was fantastic. I mean, based on that meeting, there was a couple of other people that were blogging, but then based on that meeting, there was this, you know, real sudden spike in the, especially young women who decided they wanted to, they could do this and they wanted to blog. And there's a little community of us now who are, you know, I think I have some of their, you know, blogs on here. So, and they tell very human stories in much the same way. And they're so articulate, so many of them. I mean, it's, you know, it's their only outlet really to the world, literally right now. And a lot of them are university students, but they also can't, you know, this is one of them. It's called Gaza Diaries, A Peace and War. A lot of them are English literature students. They're very articulate. I mean, the kinds of books that they read and the people that inspire them are everyone from, you know, Frederick Douglass, Malcolm X, to all kinds of people. It's really interesting. This is another friend of mine. Her name is Nina, who has a blog called 360 Kilometers Squared of Chaos. And this is the third one by a young woman called Samiha. And actually, a couple of them, one, there's another well-known blog in the US, a Jewish-American blog called Nanda Weiss, and it's a compilation of lots of different authors, but they have these awards every year, and they had a contest, and two of them won the contest for the best blog entries. I mean, they're really fantastic resources for people wanting to learn more about that kind of perspective. And I have them all linked on my blog, too, at the bottom, if anyone's interested. Anyway. Yeah.
How were the tunnels between Egypt and Palestine affected by the uprising? And
do you Egypt?
Yeah. And do you, what, how do you see them being affected as the government transitions?
Mm-hmm. You know, interestingly, during the uprising, Palestinians were very cautious. You know, whether it was the government, you know, cautioning people or people themselves not wanting to kind of, you know, generally speaking, they try not to kind of irk the Egyptian government more than they can afford to, because that's their only, again, outlet to the world. And even though they had enforced the blockade with Israel, but particularly in the uprising, they kind of slowed down the tunnel trade. It just kind of came to a standstill. But also because there were their Egyptian counterparts, a lot of them weren't there. People had fled the border. The Egyptians had fled the border, and so that trade kind of was suspended for that period, that month. And interestingly, there were stories of Egyptians who didn't have you know, anywhere to go and were actually being fed by the Palestinians. There was a few stories in the beginning that were remarking like, oh my gosh, the besieged population is, you know, providing for the Egyptian soldiers and others that were on the Egyptian side of the border. There was a few cases of Palestinians escaping who were political prisoners who escaped from Egyptian jails and made it back to Gaza through the tunnels. But otherwise, they kind of suspended the trade until things got back on track. I think it remains to be seen, but if a new Egyptian government has a more favorable relationship with the Palestinians and not like a proxy kind of government that enforces the blockade, there would be no need for the tunnel trade. The only reason it ever existed was when, again, it's this commerce relationship with the border, direct relationship. When the border closes, the tunnels start. So if the Egyptians were to allow some sort of commerce or to open the Rafah crossing, because the problem is a lot of the commerce, not all of it comes through Egypt. A lot of the main, let's see if I have that, a lot of the main terminals are along the side on the right over there with Israel, not with Egypt. And so that needs to be opened, those need to be opened for trade with Israel, not by Egypt. But if they were to open the Rafah crossing continuously, because there is some trade through Rafah, then there wouldn't necessarily be a need for the tunnels. I mean, in 2006, 2007, the tunnel trade was basically restricted to basic things like things that were profitable and easy to transport, cigarettes or spark plugs, but nothing like what it is today, because there was no need for that. So right now they're kind of adopting a wait and see approach, you know, to what might happen.
Especially in light of recent events in Egypt and Libya, you've noticed the younger population rising up. They've had a major influence. I'm just wondering, what's the atmosphere in the younger population of Gaza, 20, 30-year-olds, and how do you see them moving forward?
Yeah, there's actually half of Gaza's population is under the age of 18, so it is a very young population. And of course, you know, I was kind of mocking the role the statistics play, but there are very high rates of unemployment and poverty. The difference is in Gaza, because there's not equally, but very high rates of poverty and unemployment in Egypt and elsewhere in Tunisia as well. The difference in Gaza is those were kind of statistics that were, you know, that were created in a very calculated manner. It wasn't something that came about by bad economics or whatever. I mean, it was, you know, as a direct result of both the occupation and the siege that was also backed by regional power, by other Arab countries, not just by Israel. You know, working towards, okay, this whole policy of, you know, punishing the population, preventing employment, prosperity, things like that, has created an unprecedented situation of, you know, high poverty rates and unemployment. So there is, and you know, I'll show you a little clip that one of them made. But there, it's a very intelligent, entrepreneurial young population, very innovative, and they want to be able to do things. And you know, that was again what I kept hearing. You want to be able to, you know, not just get jobs. You want to be able to innovate and to learn new skills and things that they can't. I mean, basic things like getting a book to read. They can't do that. Those are some items that are banned under the blockade. And so, you know, often whenever we have people going there, we get requests from what kind of books they want, and we send it to them. But basic things like that, attending conferences, you know, visiting family members, they want to be able to do things like that. I also have a video of this one young rapper who basically says, we don't want to eat, we want to build, we want to prosper, we want to do. And that's what I kept hearing, is the seizure of freedoms. And, you know, but they, so, you know, they try their best, and they are very, as I was saying, innovative, increasingly going online now. There's a lot of IT consulting that's beginning to happen in Gaza, mainly to, you know, it's outsourced from other Arab countries like Dubai to Gaza, so that's something nascent, but it's beginning to happen. Let me see if I can find this video. This is one activist friend of mine who is a community activist, and he's also a photographer. But he does a lot of these kind of little abstract videos, and in this one, just to translate, it's really short, but it's in Arabic. He just basically is calling the UN and asking to speak to someone responsible, and it's of course a satire. And he's put on hold continuously, and he keeps asking at the end, hello, hello, is anyone there? And I was there during the time, and it was really ugly and a lot of acrimony and runs very deep and between families on opposite sides of the parties. And so there was this whole period of 3 or 4 years marked by a lot of feelings of apathy and not just indifference, but kind of helplessness and not being able to do anything about the situation. That's changing. we're finally there. In March 14th and 15th, there was demonstrations in Gaza and the West Bank to call for an end to the Palestinian disunity. It's basically a call for Palestinian unity, because there's two quasi-governments now in the West Bank and Gaza, to call for that to end and to create a unity government once again, as a first step to kind of standing as a united front to regenerate kind of interest in a new non-violent resistance and all to end the occupation. So there's this new stream now emerging among them.
Do you have a question?
Yeah. Oh, between which? Then between the different Palestinian governments, you mean? I mean, lots of things, but namely, Fatah was the main Palestinian party that has dominated Palestinian politics for, you know, over 60 years. It was the party that started as a student group founded by Yasser Arafat, and then, it was the main party in the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization. And Hamas wasn't around at the time. They were founded much later in the late 1980s, around the time that the first Palestinian uprising started in 1987. And then ever since, Hamas is an Islamic party, and Fatah is a secular, I don't know the best way, because there's also PFLP, which is a Marxist party. So that's not really the difference. What happened is in the 90s, Fatah continued to dominate Palestinian politics. And Palestinians were getting very disillusioned with the state of things, with the lack of progress in the peace process, with broken promises, broken truces. The Palestinian state never came about. But also because of the corruption that riddled Fatah, the Palestinian party. Because they were getting tons of money, the faucets were being opened from donors all over, and their families, living in lavish villas and putting their schools and kids in schools in Switzerland and this, that, and the other. Well, Palestinians voted mainly to kind of punish Fatah in 2006 and elect Hamas. And much to their surprise, they won by a small margin. And that came as a huge shock to Fatah. That was the beginning. But there was also always a lot of tension between them. In the 90s, Fatah security chiefs at the time, Hamad Dahlan and Jabir Ajoub, tortured members of Hamas in prison and so on and so forth. And so there was residual, elements of that lasted through to 2000. And then when they won, Fatah didn't want them to take control over the security forces. That was the big thing, question. Hamas said, we don't want to do it alone, we want a unity government, we can't do it alone. And Fatah refused. And then eventually when Hamas created its own government, they wouldn't give them control over the Ministry of the Interior. And then the US and the CIA got involved. And eventually they did broker unity government in the Mecca Agreement in 2007. But that was sabotaged by the CIA funded, the same guy who had tortured them in the 90s, Mohammed Dahlan. And eventually the unity deal was sabotaged and they kind of got at it, the two parties, and in a really bloody battle called the Battle for Gaza in 2007, in which members of both sides committed a lot of really awful, acts against each other. And that is, so that real, that acrimony and hatred is still kind of existing between them. But namely, since 2007, they keep saying, okay, we want to broker, an agreement to end this, because Fatah then fled to the West Bank and controls the West Bank, and they're the ones that are recognized by international governments, and then Hamas retained control of Gaza. And Hamas was saying, well, they're not legitimate because they didn't win the elections, and vice versa. And people were getting fed up and saying, okay, we recognize there was a lot of things that happened that were wrong, the CIA got involved, but we want a unity deal to be formed. And over the years, what was happening was the Mubarak regime kept, favoring Fatah and favoring the narrative that basically favored ultimately the Israeli occupation of making them the subcontractors for Israel's security, not giving them control over the security branches. And they wanted a more equitable agreement. And so now people are saying maybe with the new Egyptian government, there's a hope that there will be demands on both sides that are met in the Palestinian parties so that there can be a unity government that's brokered.
So that has nothing to do with this different ethnic tribe?
Oh, no. Yeah, it has nothing to do with that. No, sorry, I know you should have asked that. I could have just said no. It's being a long-winded answer, sorry. Yeah, no, it's not different ethnic tribes. It's more, it's political, yeah. Religion doesn't really play a major role. It's more kind of who has the role of writing the Palestinian narrative. That's the way that it was seen, especially when they won in the elections, so, yeah.
Could you talk about Gladstone's recent revision of his own report?
Yeah, sure. Just to clarify, I contributed a chapter to a book about the Gladstone report, which was co-edited by Philip Weiss and Adam Horowitz, who are co-editors of this blog, Mondo Weiss, that I was mentioning earlier. Anyway, and there's a bunch of other people who contributed. I mean, essentially, I was never a huge fan of the report. I mean, I was approached to contribute a chapter to the book, and my first reaction was, you know, why are you writing a book about the report? And then, you know, ultimately, I wrote more of a, it was basically a sort of a one entry in my blog that I created into a longer piece. But, you know, whatever he, you know, has, first of all, obviously, he was subject to a lot of, you know, criticism and pressure over the years. But, you know, we have to remember that he himself is a very staunch Zionist, and he's said that openly. There's never been issue to that. He himself has, you know, ruled against anti-apartheid activists when he was in South Africa. So, fine, but whatever he, you know, opinion he has or changes doesn't change the documented realities on the ground before and after Cass left. And that's kind of the takeaway, is that no matter what he thinks, you know, Israeli investigations came up with, or whatever he thinks, opinions he thinks we should have changed, the reality is there is actually an official Israeli policy, for example, in the buffer zone I was showing earlier, that actually allows, it's called Beit Salem, the Israeli NGO, refers to it as lethal ambiguity, which basically allows Israeli soldiers this kind of gray area, you know, of, okay, well, we're not going to question you. And, you know, they can act without impunity, essentially. And in the buffer zone, they're allowed to shoot at any moving thing within, and this was a, you know, within the IDF protocol. It was initially 100 meters, and then it was extended to, I think, 500 meters within that buffer zone. They can shoot at anything. And it happens very, very frequently. I was giving the statistics earlier of the children that were killed and so forth in that buffer zone. So it doesn't change those, you know, realities on the ground, the kinds of things that you hear as well, the stories that are documented, the eyewitness testimony, and so on and so forth. Whatever his opinion is, really. So.
Considering how densely populated Gaza is, what do Gazans want to, like, how are they approaching that issue? Do they want more land to kind of make it, you know, have more space to live in, or are they just looking at lower birth rates?
It's interesting, because the whole birth rate thing is really viewed as a political tool. For a long time, there's been a history of Palestinians are known to have a lot of kids, and for a while, if you study the first Intifada, there was this notion that, you know, for every one of our sons that you kill, we're going to give birth to two more. And there still is this notion of it's a battle of demographics, and we're going to do what we can to contribute, and so we're going to, you know, because it's like the statistics say by 2020, essentially, Palestinians will outnumber Palestinian, you know, Christians and Muslims will outnumber Israeli Jews in the whole territory. So there is this demographic battle going on. But in terms of what they're doing for the land, you know, there's Palestinians try to, the most densely populated areas are the refugee camps and the surrounding areas. And so they try to kind of spread out if they can get land. But land has become very, very expensive unless you've inherited it from, you know, a family or something like that. So what they tend to do is if your father or whoever it is that you're, whoever's house you're living in, can afford to, he just basically, they build, vertically. And so they will have, you know, a second story, a third story for, you know, whatever sons they have to eventually make their lives there, their, you know, raise their families there when they get married. And that's what they tend to do. And they won't stop the building, so they'll keep these wires up and so that whoever wants to keep building. So that's what's been going on. There was a boom in the 90s of building these high-rise towers. But that's really stopped. That was at a time when there was a lot of investment going on. But that poses all sorts of problems now, like the electricity and the elevators and things like that. So they do try to just build kind of vertically. But there's not much more they can do than that, obviously. So.
A lot of Arab states nearby even offer people leaving Palestine like refugee status, and they're still pretty widely in the street. I was wondering if you could explain why that is and like how that affects the Palestinian psyche, so I have nowhere to go.
Yeah, I mean, it's always been this kind of contradiction of sorts because, and it, you know, to understand why that's the case, why Palestinians are so mistreated in other Arab countries, you have to understand, you know, who were the regimes that are in control of these countries. People never understood that. I think now that people have a better understanding that essentially you have all these really repressive regimes, a lot of them proxies as well, of the United States and so forth, like the Mubarak regime and elsewhere. And always, the excuse they used was, oh, well, if we were to allow Palestinians to come here and give them whatever it is, residency or citizenship, then they would forget, you know, the Palestinian cause and they you know, the calls would die down or whatever. That was always the official excuse that was used. But of course, it went beyond that and involved a lot of really bad politics from the governments. But I think that's going to probably change, and it has a little bit, you know, eased up in places like Lebanon and Syria as well. You know, as we see maybe a change in the regimes of the Arab world. But certainly some of the places it's most difficult to travel together, you know, as a couple, my husband and I, isn't the Arab world, you know. If I can go to one country, he can't go there. So it's, we're always going our separate ways.
Can you speak a little bit more on kind of that? Like, yeah. Just the idea of what the effects of kind of this, all the Arab Spring would be on Israel.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. I mean, obviously Palestinians were ecstatic, basically, to see the result. I mean, initially they were very cautious and wanted to see again how this would all unfold before they got too excited. Because generally speaking, if they've ever taken a position or a side, there's been repercussions, you know, so they kind of wanted to wait and see. People were comparing it to the, you know, in the Gulf War when Yasser Arafat decided to take sides along with King Hussein of Jordan with Iraq at the time, and then what ended up happening were repercussions of all Palestinians who ended up getting kicked out of Kuwait if they were workers there, or, you know, whatever else. Egypt banned them from entering Egypt for a decade, and so on and so forth, even though it wasn't, you know, their decision, obviously. So in this circumstance, too, they wanted to be wary to make sure, what if this didn't work out as planned, if Mubarak stayed in power, you know, they would be the ones that we punished, ultimately. And they depend on Egypt, again, to open the Rafah crossing. But when the news did come that he resigned, I mean, they were excited, there were celebrations all over Gaza City, because they really saw this as the beginning of the end, they hoped, of the blockade on Gaza, and of a kind of a start of a new relationship, you know, with Egypt and with the Palestinians, which can play a much stronger regional role, not to answer your question, and get more involved, I think, along with Turkey in terms of, you know, brokering a peace both within, between Fatah and Hamas, but also, you know, between Palestine and Israel. So, and a more, you know, even-handed and equitable approach, I should add, that's really the most significant thing, not one that's been going on right now. So now that's what I think they're looking for, them to take on a stronger role as a regional leader, if we're talking specifically, you know, about Egypt. Yeah. But it's been something that's on the mind of Palestinians for decades, because we've had to kind of go, you know, endure, you know, all of that repression, having to go through Egypt to Gaza since we were little, at whatever given point, however the politics change, you know, one decade there's a time when we can't go through Egypt, because they're not giving us visas to even approach the Rafah crossing, you know, and then one year they are because they're easing the restrictions, and so we've always had to deal with that, whether being stranded in airports. You know, when I was young in high school, I have a blog entry, it's not in the book, but it's in the blog about when I was in high school having a trial where I had to wait 14 hours in the airport, and I was with a teacher who went with me at the time, and we were attending a conference, and she insisted that I just kind of wait and not give up, and that was my first experience, I say, the entry, kind of standing up to that regime and kind of overcoming this mental barrier of fear. But then, you know, even years later, a few years ago, they wouldn't let me in, I was with my two children, and that's something that I have in the book, and I had tweeted it at the time live, and eventually we were deported back. So we were always having to deal with their, you know, these kinds of policies, and especially having to deal with the border guards, who can be real brutal to Palestinians, whether you're at the Rafah crossing or in the airport, and often put them in military detention for, you know, days or weeks at a time, and nobody even knows, because no one's going to ask about a Palestinian who's in, you know, detention. They might ask about a German or about a, who knows, even another Arab. But during the uprising, there was, you know, there was thousands of Palestinians who were detained within Egypt. They weren't allowed to travel in the airport. They were also imprisoned, and nobody knew. I mean, they, you know, during the time of the uprising, and then when the regime, I guess the regime hasn't changed yet, but when he resigned, that, you know, they were allowed out, I guess. It's not, you know, there's a lot of Palestinians who are very mobile, if that's kind of the best way to address it. It's not as though it's a population that's just kind of, you know, born there, raised there, doesn't move. Certainly that applies to a lot of people. But also, Palestinians, remember, there's a huge part of the population that live in diaspora, or in between, who lived all their lives on the outside and only go to visit, but that's the only identity document they might have, even though they're not born or raised. That's very common too. But there was tens of thousands of Palestinians living in the Gulf until the Gulf War, when a lot of them were evicted, you know, from their various host countries and so forth, particularly from Kuwait. And a lot of them did go back to Gaza in the 90s, and you'll find a large population that were born and raised in the Gulf and only went back to Gaza in the 90s. So it is pretty common to have people living in, you know, more than one country and still have a Hawiya and go back on a regular basis or whatever. So it's become more and more difficult to do that. It used to be that the border was more open so people could afford to do that, but physically it's become so difficult now, especially for a lot of young people. There's a handful of scholarships. When I did my master's, it was on a scholarship that was dedicated specifically to Palestinians. It was funded by the State Department, and that's been kind of phased out. There's the Fulbright, but they were having trouble getting the Palestinians out of Gaza for a while. And so, you know, all the kinds of things, the different academic scholarships, you literally need to lobby to be able to, you know, different media groups and so forth, to be able to get out. I mean, when I was in Gaza this summer, one blogger, this guy Bashar, told me that he was approached by that Israeli NGO Pisha to sponsor a student who had won a scholarship. And what they meant by that is, you know, blog about him on a regular basis, raise enough attention about him so that hopefully, you know, his name will be out there and they'll eventually give him the permit to leave Gaza so he can go study. Because just because you got the scholarship doesn't mean you can actually go and do it. So it has become much more difficult in that sense.
So you were talking a lot about this sense of helplessness and hardship of everyday life, and that's what I get when I went to the refugee camp in Lebanon. And
yeah.
You know, people my age just sitting on the street and not having much to do because the limited amount of jobs they can have and the impossibility.
And in Lebanon it's worse in some ways because I mean, there's only so many things they can do, and a lot of the young people end up immigrating to, you know, Europe or Sweden and Norway and so forth.
Of course. It's really hard or impossible for them to go to universities and so on. So this impossibility of policies. And then, so if you can, and I was thinking about the Israeli settlement on the Palestinian areas and land, and how these policies really work for the So what do you see the future is like, how these people can relate to this question?
Yeah, I mean, the one population of Palestinians that are often the most neglected and subject to the most hardship are the Palestinians that live in Lebanon. So they're basically refugees or descendants of refugees, Palestinians, who fled or were forced to flee or were evicted from their homes in 1948. Generally from areas of northern historic Palestine, modern-day Israel, in the Galilee and Haifa, Acre, that area, and went to either Syria or Lebanon. And so in my husband's case, his family grew up in a refugee camp in Baalbek in Lebanon. There's about 400,000 of them in Lebanon. And they're subject to some of the most stringent conditions. There's dozens of professions they're not allowed to work in. That it's a law in the Lebanese government, and they have to do it through a proxy, someone who sponsors them or whatever. And basically, it's almost like they're living in little, reservations kind of thing, you know, in the refugee camps. Their life is all there, everything they do, they don't really intermingle with Lebanese society. But they have little to no, zero civil rights. But also, the more problematic aspect of this, by virtue of Oslo, what Yasser Arafat did by signing Oslo, and why so many Palestinians disagree with it, is it essentially marginalized that entire segment of Palestinians by doing things like excluding them. And this was an Israeli condition that Yasser Arafat agreed to. They can't vote in the Palestinian elections. That's a call that the youth of the March 14 movement has asked to change, that they need to be allowed to vote in Palestinian elections. Like Iraqis can vote wherever they are. So they can't vote, they were excluded from things. And the idea was, if you could psychologically exclude them from this process and from the voting, and from, you can also kind of begin to divorce the idea of right of return of these Palestinians, ultimately, you know, allowing them to return to their homes or the Palestinian territories in a final status negotiation. And so they feel completely marginalized. They are politically marginalized, and you know, And it feels as though it's one community, though, I should say. You know, if you ever are speaking to them or go there and go to another camp in Jordan or Gaza, it all feels like the same place. And because of course, modern-day technology, satellites, and the internet, there's way there they allow the different students from the refugee camps to communicate with each other and so forth. But they are completely marginalized, and you know, many worry, well, what is their future? What is, okay, you have the refugees in Gaza, on the West Bank, but at least they're on, that's what they say, on Palestinian territory, even though that's not where they're from. But these people, they're not even on Palestinian territory, and no one is really asking about what their future is or what their rights are. In terms of, you know, where the future is, generally speaking, I always say that I don't think there's any future for a two-state solution. Meaning that I'm a proponent of a one country, one democratic country. So kind of, you know, going against the grain of this whole notion of land for peace and having two states based on the Oslo Accords. I mean, people don't realize it, but in the Oslo Accords, there makes no mention of Palestinian state. And the idea behind it was to forestall Palestinian statehood for as long as possible. And actually, that was a direct quote from the advisor to former Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, was that the disengagement from Gaza was intended to be formaldehyde, to freeze the political process for as long as possible. And so people, you know, have this notion that, you know, Oslo or, you know, it means that peace is just around the corner, but we just keep avoiding it for some reason. And so that's not true. And so increasingly more and more Palestinians are proposing this notion of having almost a civil rights-like movement, an anti-apartheid-like movement for equal rights in one country, which could accommodate everyone, from the settlers who have taken people's land and to the refugees who want to return to their homes. And the reason a two-state solution wouldn't be feasible is because the settlements in the West Bank, coupled with the barrier, the annexation barrier, and the seam lines, those buffer zones, swallow up more than half of the land in the West Bank and effectively annex that land. And it's also not sustainable in the long run. So a one-state solution is sustainable and it's feasible. And it can also be the most democratic of solutions, because if you're just looking at it from a purely demographic perspective, you know, Israel can't retain its Jewish character, meaning have a Jewish majority for more than 20 years without resorting to kinds of institutionalized forms of racism, such as loyalty oath, population transfers, things that they've already been doing, actually. They just passed a kind of loyalty oath a few days ago, and they're going to revoke any, you know, the way they phrase it is, we're going to revoke the citizenship of anyone who's viewed to be a traitor by the state or something like that. But it applies to a lot of Palestinians who are also Israeli citizens, you know, who are stayed there in 1948. In the Knesset, for example, they're revoking their citizenship. And so without revoking to things like, resorting to things like that, applying citizenship revocation to Palestinians of East Jerusalem, where the same laws don't apply to Jewish residents of the city. In other words, as a Palestinian, if you're not there every 3 years, you get your citizenship revoked, but that doesn't apply to Jewish residents of Jerusalem. As a Palestinian refugee, you can't go back to your land. So there's no law, the law of return, there's an Israeli law of return, only applies to Jews, not to Palestinians. So if you were a Jew and you could trace your ancestry 4 generations back, even if you've never been there, you can go and immediately get Israeli citizenship. But if you're a Palestinian whose parents were born there, you're not allowed to go back to your native home, even for a visit, you know, let alone. That's the trend in the future. And Israeli leaders themselves, like Ehud Olmert and others, recognize, they've said that if we don't basically come up with any kind of Palestinian state, even if it's a titular Palestinian state, something that is not sustainable, or, you know, it can be Bantustans for all we care, but if something called a Palestinian state, we're going to end up facing an apartheid-like struggle for independence. And he said that after the Annapolis conference a few years ago. So they themselves recognize this is where it's headed, basically.